You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
Hey, everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the CyberWire's Research Saturday. I'm Dave Bittner, and this is our weekly conversation with researchers and analysts, tracking down the threats and vulnerabilities, solving some of the hard problems of protecting ourselves in a rapidly evolving cyberspace. Thanks for joining us.
Well, initially, it was a discovery made by Sulian and team. So they had identified this new variant of ErSniff. The team itself has, for a long time, done research into that malware family. And I think that we even had some of the initial research on the last publicly disclosed variant, which was Saigon, which was fairly short-lived.
Our guests this week are Jeremy Kennelly and Sulian Lebeg from Mandiant. The research is titled From RM3 to LDR4, ErSniff Leaves Banking Fraud Behind.
In June 2022, we catch a new campaign wave.
That's Sulian Lebeg.
With a classic pattern that it's a classic big mail where the content was some human resource recruitment from a company called Michael Page. And Michael Page, for those who are unaware, it was also the same kind of pattern used by RM3 banking malware. And the thing that catch us, it's we were supposed to see an RM3 payload for this banking malware. Weirdly, we saw that on our side, our monitoring was unable to identify it. So we did a deeper investigation into it, and we realized that it was a totally new branch of this banking malware. And the fact it was even old, it's in fact, there was not anymore any banking features inside, but it was just remodeled as a simplified backdoor with very specific purposes.
So this was a distribution campaign we would have previously expected to deliver ErSniff RM3 and instead was delivering this new malware, correct?
Exactly.
Can you give us a little bit of the background here? I mean, ErSniff itself has been around for quite a while, yes?
Exactly. So basically, ErSniff, if you want to do some archaeology stuff, it started in 2006. And over the time, with a lot of upside down, a lot of things happened around in the 2010s. Years, some stuff goes a bit weird because the code was split into two big parts. So we call ErSniff V2 or GOSI V2. And this side was going into a very specific position. And on the same side, a fork called ISFB arrived into the market in 2012, 2013. And this branch is currently the only alive branch from ErSniff. And it seems that this specific branch was working into a very unique marketing model. It's like every person that wanted to get part of the code have to pay, it seems, the developing team kind of royalties to have their own specified fork. So all the Ursniff variants that you are seeing since 2013 that have a very specific name means it's unique gang behind that have all the royalties behind. So if you are hearing, for example, ISFB Dreambot, ISFB AAP, or ISFB RM2, and now RM3 and Loader 4, are just basically a very unique gang behind that paid for having their unique piece of code just for them.
Well, let's dig into this discovery here of LDR4. Can we walk through how someone would find themselves victim of this and then what happens next?
I can give a brief beginning to this, and then Sully, and you can kind of pick it up if I drop anything. In theory, there's many vectors by which someone could become victim to the malware. The malware itself is transparent to the delivery vector. However, what we ourselves have seen, and historically what we've seen with other variants of malware used in a similar fashion, is that generally the initial access vector is going to be via email, which is what we saw in this case as well. The one thing that's different as far as the outcome is that, you know, following the trend that we've seen across many different malware families previously used for credential theft or as banking trojans, is that a lot of that functionality has been stripped out. So it's more clear in this case that the users of this malware have shifted to a model where they're likely looking to obtain access to networks rather than specifically looking to harvest credentials or generate fraudulent banking transactions on victim hosts.
Well, let's walk through the actual behavior here. I mean, someone finds themselves infected with this. What's going on their system, and what is it capable of doing?
So basically, when you are infected, it's the first thing is doing the malware is to do some requests that are hard-coded into the payload itself. The requests are just basically some fingerprinting, checking if it's from a corporate network or no. And so it's a basic system info request. And thanks to this, the malware will push it into the C2 servers. And then the ground behind can do just a simple triage to classify the bot as interesting and garbage, I would say, like this. So the garbage one will be reselled into credential harvesting stuff. And the good one will be set for reselling the machine for lateral attacks for some ransomware gang. So they will give the machine to some red team affiliates ransomware gang, and then starting to do some, you know, the classic stuff for getting access step by step to the whole architecture of the whole network of the victim machine, if it's on corporate network, then trying to do some credential harvesting or trying to steal all kind of juicy information. And when it's done, pushing the ransomware payload. This is how it's going right now.
I think it's also important to note that as soon as, you know, effectively the way this is working is it's opening a door up to the attackers who sort of operate Loader 4 itself. So they have a panel that will allow them to sort of make decisions about how they want to treat that access. And so everything that happens after Loader 4, although, you know, we've certainly seen many consistent trends across the tools and malware and general behavior of the attackers that are engaging in post-exploitation, you know, data theft and ransomware operations, you know, it is human-driven at that point. So it's difficult to speak with too much detail about what exactly will happen once they've decided that that access is worth monetizing. But, you know, it will follow a larger trend of these kind of, ransomware intrusions, which do, again, follow a similar arc, but will be completely dependent to the particular operator.
The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business. So this provides the backdoor into the system, and then from there, they can basically run whatever code they choose. Is that accurate?
Technically, they can just do very specific command like loading a DLL into the machine victim, starting to do some remote shell activities like starting the shell on the machine and do what they want on it. And the last type of command is just to run a simple CMD command like, okay, I want the hostname code, I want the IP config of the machine, I want the hostname of the machine. It's like they have a really simple terminal access on every kind of machine that have this malware installed.
And these simple tools effectively give them arbitrary access. But it is a very simple set of tools that this gives them access to.
I see. So what do we make of, if anything, of the fact that they've sort of distilled this tool down? As you mentioned, they've removed some of the banking functionality in here, making this a more simplified tool. Is there anything to be made of that in terms of why they would be doing that?
Just to answer this question, you have to understand that for years and years and years, the banking malware was a very lucrative business. And over the years, this lucrative business start to, of course, decline. And the thing is like also over the years, all the banking fraud has been basically monitored and also, there is a lot of solutions these days for banking customers to help them to counter-attack this kind of fraud. So over the years, the bad guys or the gang behind this kind of activities have their return of investment decreasing. And so they have to find basically more and more skilled people. They need a lot of money, so you have to pay them. Also, you have to pay the money laundry side. So you have to find some money mules, a manager behind, and then you have to be sure that the money laundry will go on in the correct way. So you have to think that this budget is rising. And on the other side, because this budget is rising, the money behind all this business will decrease. So over the years, it was okay, and it reached at a point or it was not interesting to do it. And with the ransomware coming and rising over the time, they realized that, okay, by removing all this money mule side and all this activity about recruiting skilled guy for trying to fraud, they remove everything and they have just basically now one single thing. Try to provide a very specific malware that give access to the Red Team affiliate ransomware gang. And just by having a percentage of getting access to it to get the ransom after deployed is more interesting than all the process I explained before, because there is just much less people involved and somehow it could be safer for them to have less mistake and also less processes into the pipeline to get the money clean or to do the money laundry, because now there is not anymore any transaction to be to be done, it's just cryptocurrency stuff and then just going to any kind of companies that can switch your Bitcoin into the currency you want, and the work is done.
I'm curious, so in terms of organizations protecting themselves against this, what are your recommendations? What are some of the best ways to prevent falling victim here?
I think from a high level, it hasn't really changed the model overall. This is most notable because it's an evolution of a historically very important, fairly prevalent banking malware, which just in itself is following a larger trend. So we've seen, for example, with Drydex and TrickBot, which were highly complex, fully featured, intensely developed banking malware. We didn't see them get rebuilt in exactly this way, but we did see them evolve to get used in this same way. And so I think what this does is it just further highlights an overall trend of malware previously used for banking now sort of shifting to be, one of the last bastions out there, kind of shifting to a model where it's now, very clearly being intended for used to provide access. I think, kind of expanding on the previous answer as well a little, I think that, it was also clear that the developers behind RM3 or that malware, because of the deprecation of Internet Explorer, which it relied on so heavily for much of its functionality, it was required that they rebuild their ecosystem. And so this sort of rebuilding process presumably gave them a chance to kind of rethink what their objectives were, what their market is. And, they clearly showed by what they ended up with as a tool here that access is their objective. And kind of pivoting back as far as defending yourself, what to expect. I think that, it's still this stage of the attack, there's lots of sort of generic approaches that a lot of practitioners take, which are still important, around sort of general, network hygiene, ensuring that you have, appropriate defenses at the email layer, that you're detonating payloads, and all of these things still remain important. But one, I think that from my perspective, once they get into the network, that's where we start to see a lot of this activity converge. And so there's it's also really important that defenders pay attention to sort of not just the way all this activity is highly distinct, but the way it is all similar. And so we see lots of use of things like, again, as Julian stated, Cobalt Strike, Brutal Rotel, other attack frameworks like that, common tools for privilege escalation or lateral movement, things like AD find, things like common exfiltration tools such as rclone, legitimate utilities such as psexec and bloodhound. There's lots of sort of common points of common points that attackers touch networks with that are common across all of this activity. So I think that answering questions about, defense individual cases like this is challenging, since I think it doesn't significantly change the threat landscape, but it does give us an opportunity to kind of at least highlight the ways that this activity is similar across cases.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I think the bigger picture that you point out here, Jeremy, just that, we are seeing, or we have seen this evolution, and I guess to some degree, some specialization here of, jettisoning the parts of these malware families that are no longer necessary.
It also follows another trend we see, not universally, but in cases, I think, where actors are rebuilding their toolkits, we do see them move towards simplicity. So, that's a trend that has actually existed for quite a long time, right? I think even if you look at earlier banking Trojans, including RM3 itself, that sort of had a modular plugin-based architecture where much of the functionality of the malware was loaded post-exploitation or post-execution. I think that, you know, that was sort of one of the early attempts at, you know, simplification. And I think we see that further here, right? We see a change towards, okay, well, maybe we're not looking for a big piece of malware that can do anything. We are looking to obtain access. And so we will focus on the functionality that allows us to meet that objective. And I think we saw something also fairly similar with the evolution from, again, this is a different group of cyber criminals, but the shift from using TrickBot to BazaarLoader. And then furthermore, a subset of those actors are now using, I think, what's publicly called Bumblebee or WeTrack as Shell Sting, where we again see a further shift of, you know, sort of from large, complex malware families down to smaller, more purpose-built loaders to enable network access when that is the sort of the core objective.
Our thanks to Jeremy Kennelly and Soulian Lebeg from Mandiant. The research is titled From RM3 to LDR4, Ursniff Leaves Banking Fraud Behind. We'll have a link in the show notes. The CyberWire podcast is proudly produced in Maryland out of the startup studios of Data Tribe, where they're co-building the next generation of cybersecurity teams and technologies. Our amazing CyberWire team is Rachel Gelfin, Liz Irvin, Elliot Peltzman, Trey Hester, Brandon Karpf, Eliana White, Peru Prakash, Justin Sabi, Tim Nodar, Joe Kerrigan, Carol Terrio, Ben Yellen, Nick Vilecki, Gina Johnson, Bennett Moe, Chris Russell, John Petrick, Jennifer Iben, Rick Howard, Peter Kilpie, and I'm Dave Bittner. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here next week.